You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, Melbourne's voice of dissent. 3CR Community Radio, 855 on the AM dial, streaming live at 3cr.org.au or on 3CR Digital in Melbourne.
It's 2026 and 3CR is proudly celebrating 50 years of radical radio. Based in Fitzroy in Nam, Melbourne, it serves a diverse local community and beyond through national and community language programs. I'm Judith Peppard, and I'll be looking back at a time not so long ago when the station was severely challenged and when it had to move quickly to rally resources to keep the station on air.
It was just like a ghost town. It was because, you know, 3CR is always such a bubbly place that's full of energy. So it was very odd to have this silence almost.
Pilar Aguilera, volunteer at 3CR and chair of the Board of Management from 2019 until 2026. And we'll hear more from Pilar shortly. But first of all, to set the scene, let's go back to the very beginning.
Did you know that 3CR first went to air in 1976? That's right, we're turning 50 this year.
On behalf of 3CR staff and committee, I have much pleasure in welcoming 3CR listeners and friends here at the station to 3CR's official opening. 3CR Community Radio Melbourne is Australia's first community radio station owned and operated by a federation of community organisations, 95 in all. 3CR has arisen out of the experience and need of groups and individuals in Melbourne, people who have and are fighting against mistreatment or neglect by the mass media, people who have, by and large, been denied effective access to the media.
You're listening to 3CR, 50 years of radical radio.
This year, 3CR is reflecting on those 50 years, what's been achieved, the challenges they had to overcome. And one of the biggest challenges occurred in 2020, the year that COVID arrived in Melbourne. At the beginning of 2020, 3CR was about to embark on a new five-year strategic plan. At that time, the station was home to 400 volunteer broadcasters and produced over 120 radio programs per week. The strategic plan stated that 3CR holds a deeply informed and radical philosophy about what radio can be, and through its program content, it advocates and agitates for social and political justice and transformation. But on January 28th, 2020, the first case of COVID-19 had been confirmed in Victoria, and by March 10th, the Victorian government had announced a state of emergency with lockdowns and curfews to follow.
We are declaring a state of emergency in Victoria under the Public Health and Wellbeing Act. That state of emergency will be effective from 12 noon today and will run for 4 weeks. It is likely that that state of emergency will be extended and will be in place for as long as it needs to be.
What would this mean for a small community radio station like 3CR? I was a broadcaster on 3CR in 2020, and I learned to use Zoom for interviews, as so many of us did, and huddled behind blankets so that the sound would be okay. But I didn't have the bigger picture of what had to be done to keep the station on air, and I wanted to find out. So I reached out to three people who, with the help of many others, guided 3CR through this difficult time. Pilar Aguilera was chair of 3CR board during the COVID crisis.
Thank you.
Rachel Kirby was manager of 3CR in 2020.
Hi, Judith.
And Gab Reed was 3CR's coordinator of current affairs.
Thanks, Judith.
Do you remember where you were when you first got the news about the coronavirus outbreak in Victoria?
Probably at home.
I was actually coming back from the funeral of a dear friend of mine's mother, And we wondered, while sitting on the outskirts of Melbourne, whether we'd be allowed back into the city. So I remember it really well.
Do you remember it, Rachel?
I do. I was on the couch with my kids watching the news and thinking, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it actually happened really quickly, as we'll all remember.
Yeah, it did. And how did you feel about it? Like, did you have any idea, any of you, what was coming?
No, definitely not. It was really, I think, naively, I thought, oh, this is only going to be 4 weeks, 6 weeks at the most. Little did we know.
You were just out of your Invasion Day broadcast. And you suddenly had to start doing things. So what was at the top of your mind?
We took very seriously the potential of harm to our community. And we had very thoughtful conversations at both staff level and committee level to really identify what the different needs were in our community, because obviously they're not homogenous. I don't know if we'd really gotten to the nuance of it early on. I think that came later on. But really thinking through, I think at the forefront of our decision was the harm that might be caused by the transmission of something that was still so unknown. But what we did know was that it was rapidly moving, and that those that could harm the most were the vulnerable. And we were really keenly aware that almost every identified vulnerable group at the time that the state government or federal government had been identifying had a program at 3CR. Every group that has been identified coming into our station weekly, monthly, and they're the ones that we need to be making our decisions for.
What did you have to put in place for the broadcasters to continue their work if they could?
My memory is that we acted very quickly, as Rachel said. So we locked down the station, sent out information, and we did a full lockdown from the 19th of March 2020.
Which was, from memory, at least a couple of weeks before lockdowns actually became mandated by state government, which in some ways gave us a small jump, because we had already been grappling with, well, what does it mean to shut down a community radio station that's predominantly live? What on earth does that mean?
The other thing to remember is during that time, we didn't know whether it was aerosol or contact. It was all about touching and hand sanitizing and before the social distancing around aerosol. So studios are airtight spaces. So straight away, we were only allowing one person in the studio. We were already thinking about that. The experts still hadn't decided whether it was aerosol or contact. We just planned for both, really.
You had a responsibility to inform the community, but how were you going to keep broadcasting when people couldn't even come into the studio? What did you do about that?
When I think back to that challenge, I actually remember it really fondly. It was really hard. We were really tasked with a proper good problem. And I really enjoyed how we work together as a community to solve those problems. We have a fantastic staff team, a fantastic crew of volunteers and supporters from the community, and supported at all times by a really great committee of management. So we had some really great people on these problems, and we kind of rethought, well, what do we want to do? We want to keep broadcasting. We want to keep people engaged. People were, if you'll remember, people were panicking. People were isolated and isolating from each other. So that real need still for connection and care and participation was still really, you know, these were really things people wanted and needed. Yeah. So we've, by hook or by crook, figured out ways to make that happen. And we figured out how to make the studios work for us. We set up really simple file transfer protocols, allowing people to upload things. We rejigged our website to allow people to both share content, upload content, and for us to broadcast that content. But I think really what we did is we just kind of thought about, well, what do we want to do? And then we figured out how to make that happen. And I say I remember that fondly, because I actually remember sitting at my desk and having people from our community call to speak to me and say things like, I've got a spare 2 grand. I'm going to put it in your bank account. You make sure that that person and the name of person who supports a program has got a laptop, because I know they don't have one. Or I've got four computers that I can go and get from work. You tell me where I need to drop those off to. Oh. And that's literally how we got technology into some of our communities' homes. Yeah. Well, actually, we stripped the studios too, didn't we? Every computer that was not required for a broadcast pathway we had at that time was removed from the station, tagged, and then made sure it was in the home of someone who needed it. So that was one part of the problem, putting the actual tools there. But then teaching me, I feel like part of my thing at that time was making sure resources got to where they got to go. But then how do we do all of that? And how do we keep broadcast quality up? That was more.
Yeah, I wondered about the training and how you managed it.
Yeah, well, it's funny. Memory's kind to you too, isn't it? Because actually, I think I kind of remember it fondly, but I'm sure I was pulling my hair out at the time. Again, remembering just the misinformation and the lack of information. So we just had to hit the ground running, as well as researching what it was and what the potentials were to keep our community safe, plus looking for technology to keep people connected. As Rachel mentioned in the beginning, our community here, not everyone had a laptop. People are living in shared housing with no wireless connection. So we were getting dongles and, you know, as Rachel said, people were generously donating money for us to put prepaid on that. People were using mobile phones. We were getting that people with a headphone jack. Our technicians were making cords that fit into different people's phones. We all, steep learning curve. We were training people out the back. You know, our building, if you've been to 3CR, is, you know, a small building in around the high rise now of Fitzroy. So we're in the back alley, socially distancing, but teaching people how to log into Zoom and, you know, like, and with passwords and accounts. And it was a busy time, and we're only in the there's only a few of us in the station at the time.
Yeah, I was wondering who was allowed to be in the station.
Well, as a media outlet, we were one of the exempt industries, so all of our staff could work in the station. Mm-hmm. But it required a huge amount of bureaucracy, which I had to manage. There was, I don't know if anyone remembers, but you had to submit forms. There was this, there was that. You had to get that, you had to get this. It was just like add it to the list of chores to do at the time. But I think we did, wouldn't you say, Gab? We tried really hard to responsibly use the station as well, though. We had room limits well and truly, like Gab said, and I do actually credit you with a lot of the research that you took on. We had isopropyl in the studios long before people said, oh, you should be using that. Like, you remember?
Yeah, I went deep diving into some of the kind of existing medical information from SARS. And the isopropyl alcohol and the air filters were the two things that were really important. So we got onto that very quickly, and, you know, Rachel was onto it quick, smart. We got, as she said, the last container of isopropyl alcohol in Melbourne, we think. Ooh. And plus we got the air filters sorted, made in, and we wanted them to be made in Australia. We weren't going to throw out our ethical stance on other things just with all the rubbish that was coming through. So we wanted to actually buy proper ethical, you know, we wanted to source it ethically if we could, and air filters and things like that, that in the future would be easily replaceable and not too much cost burden on the station.
Right. Which I'm pleased to see, beautiful HEPA filter down there is still here.
Still going.
Oh, yes.
We researched drum replacements, all those things that Gab said, because I think you've just kind of jogged a memory to how many almost parasitical products and marketing popped up around that time.
Definitely.
And there was a lot of money being wasted by big organisations and even the state government, really, on, you know, let's buy that. You remember Samsung filters? They were being shipped over here by the dozen, and they lasted like 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, just to go somewhere else with it, I also remember that there was a very real lack of any health messaging done in community language at that time. And our credible community broadcast languages took that on for their communities, went to health briefings, and then translated that information. They really did the hard yards without any government support.
Exactly. And I actually, that brought a memory of the towers in Flemington that were in deep, deep lockdown midway through that first year. The majority of the community there spoke Arabic, but there were also members of the community, my friend's dad being one of them who spoke Spanish. And I remember having to translate some of that messaging into Spanish because the government hadn't considered that some of the community there spoke Spanish. And in fact, he was on our one of our Spanish language programs at the time, speaking during that crazy towers that were in lockdown. 3CR became really important in terms of that messaging to the communities. Once again, radio showing how important it is. And without all that government funding, because they were recording messages, you know, government-funded messages, but not in enough languages. So,
yeah, I see. Yeah. So, and I was going to mention the community language programs you know, how you kept those on air, because they're usually a live program, and keep those going, especially since they were so important.
I think that actually the technology and the systems we set up, they were the same for everybody.
Yeah.
So really it was just making sure they had access to the things they needed to produce the shows in a way that could be sent to us. But I'd also say they were very proactive in making sure that their program went to air. I remember long after even the real intensity of it, shows like Eritrean Voices having a doctor's segment on their show every week. There was so much disinformation in their community about what the causes of COVID were, whether or not the vaccine was going to harm you.
I'd add too, in terms of technology, they're actually a great source of inspiration for us, because what people need to realise is that community languages have been doing really interesting lo-fi technological hookups way longer than some of the other English-speaking programs, because of time difference and regional distances. They've worked out how to record holding their phones up to speakers. You know, the sound quality's never been great, but they were actually, you know, ahead of their time. And yeah, they land, as well as what Rachel was saying, in terms of their community information and the role they play, their technological know-how was also really helpful to other programmers too. I was ringing them going, you know that recording you did on the phone, how'd you do it? Like
Gab Reed. And if you just tuned in, I'm chatting with Gab Reed, Rachel Kirby, and Pilar Aquilera. They're sharing their reflections on life at 3CR during lockdown, the challenges the station faced, and how they met them with the help of their very diverse community. Here's Gab again.
You just reminded me too about Talk Back with Attitude. We knew we needed to keep Talk Back on.
Yeah.
And as you,
how did you do that?
Yeah, well, that was interesting. Distancing me in Studio One, you know, closed space. Yeah. Rachel in Studio Two, closed space. Joe in his car out the back on a phone. Pat, the other presenter, at home. And we would conference call everyone. But every time a new caller came up, you have to drop all the calls. So then I'd made music stings to give myself, at first it took me 13 seconds, and then I got it down to 5. So we had the Benny Hill theme song, that was our music thing, and eventually I got it down to 5 seconds. I'd just drop the calls back on hold, take them all again, patch them through.
Amazing.
And then we'd have 3 or 4 people on the call. But yeah, that was that. Now I remember just how hectic that was.
It actually was amazing. You are amazing being able to do that. Amazing.
And what about the breakfast programs, Gab? You know, how did you manage the current affairs?
Yeah, that was really tricky. I mean, we've touched on some of the issues with that they share with everyone else, but it's a live program, as you know, Judith.
Yes.
So the programmers had never really been trained in pre-recording or editing software, so there was a really steep curve. They were also, a lot of them, in share houses. They weren't in 3-bedroom houses with a spare studio and their podcast set up. They were in their cupboards, and I was advising them on how to soften rooms. As anyone who knows me, I'm totally full on about the sound quality. So I was like, get in the cupboard, get a doona, get under the table, put a chair on it, cover it with all the blankets, cushions, soft, for, you know, soft surfaces. So they did an amazing job, but it was hard. They were separated from their team. We, you know, were trying to do interviews on our phone, on the voice memo, in parks, you know, wherever we could do it. They did such an amazing job, but it was, mental health was priority for us at that time, so we lost a few programmers who came back afterwards. But, you know, it was really hard. All the fun bits about being part of a team, coming in to the station, getting a coffee, chatting, going through the papers, looking at all the social media, that was really hard.
Yeah.
But they did an amazing job.
Yeah. And they kept going.
And they kept going. Yeah.
Yeah. One of your annual programs is Beyond the Bars, which is going into prisons and speaking to First Nations peoples. How did you approach a program like that during lockdown?
Juliet Fox, our projects coordinator, has, you know, led the organising of that project for 2 decades and a bit. So I think what we had straight away is an incredible amount of knowledge in, you know, with Juliet of imagining how this could happen and the connections and the contacts within the prison system to make that work. So again, we didn't necessarily come up with these incredible change the world systems. We just really focused on simplicity. Again, will this solve the problem? So similar to how we ran our programming, we just applied that to be on the bars, and we had people on phone calls and we recorded phone calls. So for those years, the Beyond the Bars went ahead, went to all of the prisons that it went to. And again, I suppose there was more of an imperative to do it at that time too, because
I imagine the isolation,
the misinformation. I'm just kind of being a bit slow because I'm remembering that now. That was really rough.
And I think culturally we've always serviced a really diverse group of programmers. So we had options. We didn't just have one audio setup that suited, you know, one person. We had many audio setups. So shout out to Michaela who made these kits, the radio kits, which we use the PCMs. So each had a little hand sanitizer.
What does a PCM mean? What does that mean?
Yeah, good point. It's a portable, so each kit had a portable recorder in it. So you could attach some headphones and have a microphone so you could socially distance. Put, you know, hand sanitizers in each set. We changed mic socks as a programmer, Judith. I don't know if you remember, you know, for listeners out there in the studio, we have very large mic socks that go over the microphone.
Yeah, I remember that.
So again, when we thought, you know, when the medical advice was that it was contact, we changed our socks. So we had and the headphones with the pads in them as well. So we changed them. Every producer or panelist who came in had to put a new sock on, new headphones, you know, the soft lining, and then we put them in a box and we rotated them, and we had days of the week, you know, we had 7 days and we rotated them because the advice we'd received was a 7-day sit out, you know, that, you know, they'd be not contagious after that. So we did things like that, any contact points, but also for our portable and outdoor broadcast and 3CR's connection in the community, there was rallies going on and things like that. They didn't stop, you know, people were trying to socially distance during that time. So we had to make sure people had access to that technology still. So again, you know, long story short, but it was, we have a lot of options, very lo-fi and very adaptive technology. So it didn't surprise me that we could roll some of those out. They weren't always perfect, but they did the job.
And what about music? How did the music programmers cope during this time?
I mean, music was so important. A lot of the current affairs shows transition to more music, which on reflection was kind of nice. Before that, I was cracking the whip, like, no, it's talk space. You can have 2 songs for the hour, maybe 3 if you're an hour and a half. So they loved it. They got to play a lot more music, and that's what we shared with each other. We gave people a bit of a break too.
Yeah.
I don't recall any particular songs, but I do have quite a strong memory of how many times the phone would ring to give us feedback on how grateful people in our community were for some of our music programs in particular. And what comes to mind is how many times the phone rang to say thank you to Kate and Susie for Lazy Wednesday. One, because of the joyful music that they played, but also the way in which they presented their show. And it made people feel like Kate and Susie were in their kitchens. And at a time when people were feeling lonely for that kind of having someone around your table, their show received a lot of feedback from people to say thank you.
I was going to ask how you balanced your critical radio philosophy with providing some comfort during that time. Did you even think about it and all the things you had to do?
Yeah, I reckon we thought about it a lot. And one of the things this is bringing up memories too that I haven't thought about for a long time, is that we were seeing stories out there in the community of how some people loved lockdown and they could make sourdough bread, they had a spare room. That wasn't the experience of a lot of our community. So as Rachel's already mentioned, we'd have people calling in. So we spent a bit more time on the phone with people, to be honest, and gave them that time. And also the talk back, which is why we kept the talk back up. That was a real link for people. So we heard from so many people who had never rung talk back before. And yeah, they were so grateful for the connection. And we took a bit more time with them. So much so that when the lockdown's finished, people were a little bit like, oh, Joe's has cut me off again. It's like, yeah, we're back to pre-COVID. time.
Pilar, I'm wondering about how you were feeling as a person in charge of the board, if you like, although I realize it's very collaborative. But how did you feel?
I was really lucky to work with a great station manager, Rachel, and working collaboratively, but we also had a really great committee and everyone just stepped up. You know, I remember I was chairperson, but also doing some recording for language programs in the studio, or I did one of the times come in to do talk back, or, you know, everyone was sort of collectively pulling their weight. And it felt really good to be leading a group of people that acted so quickly and that we were all on the same page thinking we need to protect our community. Because there was some discussion about whether locking the station down was the best thing. And because we were so preemptive with it and stuck to it, you know, we explained to people that it was actually for their protection. You know, and because we during that whole year when it was in lockdown, we had a lot of people saying, but when can I come back to do my show? When can I come back to live? Or when can I have more than one person in the studio? You know, like some of the music programs who have guests and stuff like that. So I felt like, yeah, it was hard to do remote, but we sort of kept each other going and kept each other on track. So yeah, it was interesting to look back through emails from that time and the little that we knew going into it, you know, naively thinking this is going to last 6 weeks and a year later, you know. Yeah. And everything was quick. Everything changed. Everything was dynamic. We had to just sort of be on the front foot with all the tech stuff, you know. We spoke about the aerosol, the HEPA filters, but we also had Perspex in the studio.
Yes, I just checked the studio to see if it's still there, but
no,
it's not.
No, we took them down eventually. But, yeah. You know, and I think like everyone, it made us really aware of what we were capable of doing as a community and as a collective. And I guess that felt really good that we got through that together.
Was fundraising an issue during that time?
It's always important for the station. Shout out to this year's Radiothon.
Rachel Kirby with a shout out to this year's 3CR Radiothon. And if you've just joined us, I'm talking with Rachel Kirby, Gab Reed and Pilar Aguilera about their experiences of the COVID lockdown and what they had to do to keep the station on air, support their volunteers and their community during that time. Here's Rachel again.
I was thinking when both of you were talking, it's I think what also emerged during that time, I think class became much more visible to many more of us during COVID, because there really was that divide of certain groups of people who had, and I don't want to overplay it, but, you know, like the luxury of a spare room, the luxury of a bit of peace and quiet. But then we had people who were stuck at home. For example, the flats up here with four kids. Like, those experiences are very different. And I think that we at the station, many more of us, even here in our wider community, were able to see that class divide much clearer during COVID. And so, like you were saying, there was definitely always push and pull in our community. It's not a homogenous community by any means. And just similar to what you're saying, Pilar, I reckon it would have been that I sent out a program of news once a week for at least 18 months, twice a week if there was a... Because it was such a rapidly moving time, wasn't it? Like, oops, sorry guys, it's now Thursday and what we thought Tuesday has changed. The government's changed their mind. But I think one of the things that really got us through, you know, say again what you said, Pilar, was we were fundamentally on the same page about why we were making these decisions. And then, you know, part of my job and the staff's job was consistent messaging, because there were always people trying to be like, well, can you just let me in? I'll be there at Thursday. And like, come on, Gab. Like, there was always that going on.
Because there were only two staff members on at any given time in the station, and they were distancing too. So, and it was rotating. So it was, yeah, it was quite strange to be here. I think I was here one of those times where there were three of us in the station, and it was just like a ghost town. It was because, you know, 3CR is always such a bubbly place that's full of energy. So it was very odd to have this silence almost.
But to go back to your fundraising question, I think what we decided to do for our radiothon that year was to have what we called a station appeal. Each year we try to raise, you know, anywhere between 220 and 250,000. And what we did that year was we just radically rethought what we thought was fair to be asking of our community at that time. And I think we more than halved the target we set ourselves. And we ran a very similar station appeal, not a radiothon, because I think we really, class was a much easier thing to see at that time, perhaps even more so than what it's gone back to. But during that time, class became really visible, and I think we adapted even how what we thought we could and should be asking of our community at that time, and we adjusted to what we needed.
Are there any other stories, I guess, that stand out for you or broadcasts or anything that happened during that time that you haven't mentioned?
One thing for me was a bit of a rediscovery of the building, because as we've all referenced, it's a busy place here. There's often a lot of distractions and a lot of people. But when we did the lockdowns and there was only a few of us here, there'd be some mornings when I was the only person here. And, you know, my job was to make sure the shows were going to air remotely if they could, or they'd sent programs through and people were remotely loading them up as well, our program coordinator was. But I discovered like old two-way communication systems, which we ended up reinvigorating, because people used to be able to communicate from one of the newsrooms to one of the studios, which is about a 10 or 20 meter distance. So it was kind of cool as well. Like, those things were already in place and they'd been hand-built. And because the station doesn't change that much, they were still in place. It just hadn't been used. So, yeah, I found – shout out to the techs, by the way, who did an amazing job both setting up the FTP servers and things like that, and so people could log into the website and share audio, but also to help us manage the systems here so that we could be socially distanced. So that, I think they did an amazing job. So for me, I got to know the station in a little bit of a different way, and we kind of became quiet buddies, so much so that when we reopened again, it was a bit like, oh, it's a bit noisy.
Oh, and what kept you going all through this time?
I think for me, I really felt like we had a real sense of purpose. We really had some things to do and things to focus on and things to solve. And this is a personal reflection, but I do remember going home some days and being like, man, why can't I just be one of these people who have learnt to make sourdough and who like have now started a jogging habit? I do remember thinking that some days, because your brain would just be so full. But my real memory of it all was actually just feeling very proud of where I worked and what my work was for. I don't mean to sound too cherry on top about it all, but I do remember feeling like I felt quite privileged to have this work and to be working with the people I got to work with to solve what was at the time. I mean, we're radio, we're not surgeons, but I do think because of what was going on at the time, radio was elevated. Radio is already pretty magical, but at that time it was even more. And I just feel like we had good things to keep ourselves busy. And I never got to start my jogging habit. Just
it was a real connection and lifeline for people. And, I mean, Rachel and Gab being staff at the time, you were here at the coalface. I wasn't, you know, I was working from home in my other job. But connecting with the committee and the staff and the community was really important. Like, yeah, I felt really proud to be leading 3CR through such a strange and surreal time. It was difficult, but it was also unknown and strange. And yeah, coming out the other side of it, I think everyone was so busy that, you know, I don't think we've had really that time to reflect on it, because it's always like a bit of a treadmill, 3CR, you know, everyone's always busy, limited resources with lots to do. But yeah, it felt like a really big achievement.
Yeah, I feel similar. I'm so proud to work here, and how people just rose through so much difficulty, and it just reflected so positively on how our community does multiple things at once. People are broadcasters here. They're at home parenting. They're volunteering in other organisations, and they did it all. You're speaking to three of us of many people who did such an amazing job finding resources. And I think I mentioned this earlier, I really did notice a difference around class. I noticed that people who had access to new modern computers, it was easy for them to transition into a Zoom work environment. We had people with sound cards that were so old in their computers that we just couldn't even get much out of it. So we had to resupply them, you know, things like that. People acted with so much grace while they were terrified, because we didn't know what was going to happen either. And we'd locked them out of one of their favourite places. So that connection, the phone calls, the station messages to people, keeping on broadcasting, we had that job to do. We kept going because it's, you know, 3CR is of value in any climate, let alone a pandemic, and it won't be the last. And I, you know, I was at the airport dropping a friend off the other day, and there was no hand sanitizer in the bathroom, and I thought, are you crazy? What have we learned? Like, and just like all of that stuff. So we'll have to relearn this.
Yeah.
It will happen again at some point. And, you know, 3CR's been here for 50 years.
50 more, we hope.
Yeah, we'll see.
You've already talked about what you've learned from the experience, that you've learned about community radio and about yourselves. So I feel you've already really covered that. Last thing is, what was it like to return to live programming?
Slow and steady. I do remember having that real control over, you know, how many people, and we prioritised, actually, from memory. We prioritised current affairs, First Nations programming to be the first ones to come back into the station, and then we rolled it out very slowly. So we were very cautious as well. It wasn't just like we opened it up and suddenly everyone can come in, and we limited the number of people in studios. So it was very slow.
I had actually forgotten that, but you're right. That's exactly how we did it. But also what you're saying, Gab, we also prioritised because we were keeping such close connections with different groups, programs, individuals. We knew who needed to come back. We knew who was struggling with that dongle that cost them $20 a week because they had no Wi-Fi at home. Like, people really were putting in the hard yards. And so it was those people who were welcomed to come back to live broadcasting first, because they actually had the most challenge to overcome to put their show on. And I remember that ruffled feathers. But again, it's all just about messaging, isn't it? It's how you talk about that that makes the difference. And when you explain, you know, took the time to share that information well, of course everybody got it. But I think there was a lot of need at that time, hey? There was all sorts of diverse needs. And one thing that I really remember of that time too, even with staff coming back and being the manager at that time, one thing I observed is that people's potential for risk or to be risk averse or to feel anxiousness really changed. Some days, you know, our staff team were like, oh my gosh. Well, not just the staff team. I think it, you know, was for all of us. But, you know, say on a Monday, we've got 8 out of 10 going, no, no, you're right. Well, you know, I've read this. This is the advice. We can let 5 people in that room now. That same 8 people on the Wednesday would then be like, oh my gosh, I can't, like, why would you do that? We can't have that many people in the room. And I don't mean that to be like judgmental, but I think at that time we were all still adjusting to this very new world of risk that we had not really ever experienced in our workplaces before. And so the slow and steady approach actually worked in evening that out. Like, I think what we managed to achieve was a sense of stability in an otherwise pretty volatile place. Like some days you'd come to work and be like, oh my God, why are there six people in this building? Gross. And then you turn up the next day and you'd be like, six? Gosh, do you remember when there were 50? Like, I think it all really took us a long time to find what our baseline was after those experiences of such extreme isolation and shutdown. It took a real while to come back, didn't it?
I've just remembered a funny story, if I could share it, about some of the technology here is that I hope listeners appreciate this, but our programmers have a lot of autonomy here. So they come and go, they have keys to the building, they set themselves up in the studio and they can log in and upload and do all that kind of stuff. So on one hand, COVID was great because it made us do some things that we'd been wanting to do, but there was no time, like give programmers access to our website and an FTP server where we could share audio, loading them up and also downloading it as well. And one of the problems with that, though, was that we'd been set up by our tech, Luke, with remote access to our computers, which to other workplaces, they'd probably been doing it already and it wasn't such a big deal. But to us, it was like Battlestar Galactica or something. We thought it was so cool. We're like, what? I can log into my computer from home? It was just like, hello, modern world. So that was amazing. But the problem was that sometimes you'd be doing a very critical, time-critical load of programming up to the on-air software that was working automatically in the background. At the same time, someone had come in, let themselves in, and had jumped on the computer, and suddenly you'd lost control of the mouse and you were just about to save your hours loading work and it would disappear. And so you'd be ringing your colleagues and a few common suspects going, are you in Studio 3? I'm on that computer remotely. So anyway, I just remembered that. That was mind-boggling. And it didn't happen just once or twice. It happened a lot. So you knew when someone was in the building because you could see the mouse moving.
Completely. Yeah. Studio 3 wars. And we had to transition all of our booking to online too to solve this because booking used to be paper, remember? Oh, the things we solved. Oh,
I'd forgotten about that.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about anything? No? We've covered it?
I'd like to say thank you, Judith. This has been such a lovely remembrance because I'd kind of forgotten about all of this. And I really appreciate that you taking the time to record this because we do forget about it and it was an amazing time.
Amazing achievement. I've really enjoyed talking to everyone too.
Thank you, Judith. And I think collectively we jogged each other's memories. But yeah. As I think Rachel said earlier, you know, we've been around 50 years.
Yes.
This year's our 50th anniversary and hopefully another 50 in the future.
And here's to another 50 years. Pilar Aquilara, chair of the board of 3CR during the COVID pandemic. Also joining me in the studio were Rachel Kirby, manager of 3CR during the pandemic, and Gab Reed, coordinator of current affairs at 3CR during that time. And to all the staff at 3CR who took us through the lockdown so capably. Michaela Stubbs, programming coordinator, Juliet Fox, projects coordinator, Leanne McLean, volunteer and training coordinator, and Loretta O'Brien, office and finance coordinator. And those incredible technicians who worked behind the scenes to make it all possible. Technical coordinator Greg Siegel, IT coordinator Luke Neeson, and technical assistant Raya Williams. I'm Judith Peppard.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.